Welcome back to Game of Thrones 2 Electric Boogaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. This week, Arthur, Jonfa, and I will be covering Tyrion's third POV chapter. Arthur and I just struck up a relationship by way of email, and we started to talk about Game of Thrones, and I decided, you know what? I think I'm going to have him on. We're going to talk a little bit about Tyrion. And of course, you know, as a student at the London School of Economics, he's a little bit like Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan. Steve and I will cover Dark Wings, Dark Words, second episode of season 3. In my Bird's Eye View section, I'll talk a little bit about the War of the Roses and parallels using Caroline Larrington's book, Winter is Coming. Caroline is a medievalist at Oxford, and she'll be on in a couple weeks to talk about our next Dany chapter. Keeping with the medievalism theme, here is medievalist Jana Matthews. Okay, this question is from Elizabeth, and she asks, the Northerners and the men of the Night's Watch wear a lot of fur as part of their daily wear, presumably to keep warm. What can you tell us about fur preservation during medieval times? Was fur restricted to upper social strata, in other words, like fancy furs?
Yeah, that's such a great question. I'm going to be speaking mostly from the perspective of kind of medieval Western culture. And so that will, just by nature of that, will enable me to provide like a partial answer. But we obviously know that people wore fur in remote tribes and they who lived off the land in Upper Scandinavia and those kinds mm-hmm. of places. And they wore what was available to them. The most common fur that we have, this is from trading records and from import-export documents that we have that we seem to think was the squirrel. And that sounds strange, right? But it would actually make sense when you think about the animal that was native to the region of Europe and throughout most of Central Asia and also pervasive and easy to access. It was right. The squirrel.
Right.
And so squirrel pelts were super, super popular. The other animals that show up in records a ton are otter and weasel and sable and marten. And sable and marten are essentially two versions or varieties of kind of an animal that is sort of a cross between a cat and a weasel is probably the best way to describe mm-hmm. what this creature was. And I think what's important about that, the question was asking about fur being restricted to social strata. And the answer is yes. Like in later years, particularly in the 14th century and beyond, fur is it's a commodity and it's a rare resource. And anything that is rare has a tendency to be commodified and used for social purposes. So starting in the 14th century, we have the rise of what we call sumptuary law. And sumptuary law or dress codes originally started with the Catholic Church. So what kind of monk you were, for example, was dependent upon what kind of clothing or outfit you're wearing. Hmm. And then that concept was eventually expanded to the secular everyday realm as well. And so some of these dress codes were for practical reasons, but in the case of fur, they were often used for economic reasons and social reasons. And so an example of sumptuary law, and I pulled this from Henry VIII, from his realm, but they had actual statutes and laws that were passed that governed and told people what they could and couldn't wear depend upon social station. So I'll read a little excerpt from this, but it says, woolen cloth made out of the realm, but in caps only. Velvet, crimson, or scarlet, furs, and then they specify black genets, and then lucernes, and then it goes on, embroidery, tailor's work. You can wear those things, but only if you are a viscount, a baron, and a knight, being a companion of the garter. And a genet is a kind of a spotted cat that's found in Spain and France, super pretty, and a lucerne is a lynx. So these are two kind of what your reader described as fancy fur. And they are also, and so this statute is saying you can only wear these kinds of fur if you are part of these noble or royal classes, and you'll be fined and imprisoned if you do wear them. There's regulations on how you could wear your hair and what you could put in it. So, and I think that important point is that just because we had regulations doesn't mean that they were rigorously enforced. And so it's we have some examples where they were enforced, but the fact that these statutes kept getting passed over and over and over again suggests that they didn't have quite the level of effectiveness that
other
people, right?
I mean, you don't need to make a big deal out of the law if everyone's already doing what they should be doing, right?
Exactly, exactly. So I think we have to kind of take these things with a grain of salt, right? Like just because we have like evidence of these laws being passed doesn't necessarily mean that people were enforcing them.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
All right. So, Arthur Jampa, welcome back to Electric Boogaloo.
Thank you.
We are talking about Tyrion, and this is prime real estate, man. People want to talk about Tyrion.
Oh, he's everyone's favorite, isn't he?
Everyone's favorite. And so I normally save this for my favorite guest. So you have a place of honor.
I have more than honors.
You've got the Tyrion real estate.
is everyone coming at you saying, give me the Tyrion chapter?
Yes, and they're going to be upset. They're like, you gave that kid the Tyrion real estate?
I mean, I got the Tyrion and Jon real estate. I mean, this is...
Yeah, this is pretty decent. But I wanted to ask you about this because one of your keen interests is Chinese history.
Mm-hmm.
And the wall features very prominently in this chapter.
Mm-hmm.
And I've done a lot of research and I've written a little bit and I've talked a little bit about the inspiration for the wall in Britain, right? So Hadrian's wall. But you mentioned to me that the wall actually probably has a lot of parallels with the Great Wall of China. And I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about that.
Yeah. I thought that, to be honest, I think the comparison between Hadrian's Wall and the Wall of Ice is probably the one that's a bit more accurate when it comes to George Martin's thinking. Like, I also did a bit of research.
And sure, yeah.
So some journalist asked him this, and he was like, oh, no, the inspiration was Hadrian's Wall. I've never been to China.
Right.
So that's what he thinks.
I mean, clearly there are some major differences between Hadrian's Wall and the Wall, right?
Yeah, and I think, like, in a way, I made three columns, but like the facts about the three walls. And I thought, you tell me if you think this is fun. I thought I could tell you like a fact about the Hadrian's Wall and then the Wall, and you can guess
Oh, and which one? Oh, right. So yeah, you've turned this on. So you're telling me that you're taking over. This is now your podcast.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, fine. You know what? That's very colonial of you, but go ahead.
Really British of me. okay. Okay. So.
Yeah. Go for it.
The wall is 300 miles. Okay.
Yeah.
And then Hadrian's Wall is 73 miles long. Okay.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Can you guess how long the Great Wall is?
Oh, Craig. See, this is, no, I can't. I can't. Here's what I'm going to guess. I'm going to make some bizarre, stupid guess based on no information. I'm not looking it up on my smartphone. I'm going to guess it is 300 miles.
It is 13,000 miles long.
Holy moly. I'm so wrong. Just
for reference, the circumference of the world is 24,000 miles.
Well, see, now I feel a little bit better because that's absolutely an absurdly long wall.
Isn't it?
Yes. Oh my gosh. Okay. Well, yeah. All right. So let's do the next one. I clearly failed that one.
Okay. The wall is 700 feet tall. Hadrian's Wall is a mere 15 feet tall. Can you guess how tall the Great Wall is? Actually, there's two heights. It's like the normal height and then the highest point.
All right. Well, I'm going to go ahead and guess the normal height.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say 30 feet.
Oh, you're bang on.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. So it's twice the size of Hadrian's Wall. The highest point is 30,000 feet, but that's like a tower on top of a hill. So
Say that again. The highest point is what?
30,000 feet.
30,000?
Yep.
Wow. So yeah, you're using the natural geography to make that happen, right?
Yeah, but in a way, it's much taller than the wall. So
that's amazing.
Right?
All right. So next one.
Okay, this one will be easier. The wall has a massive walkway.
Wait, let me ask you about the first one. Is it actually 30 feet or is it just kind of around 30 feet?
No, I think it is actually 30 feet.
Oh, wow.
Well, for my very rudimentary research.
Okay, all right, go ahead.
So the wall has a walkway that like soldiers would walk on, well, the Night's Watch.
Yeah.
Hadrian's Wall, it's debated whether it has a walkway. Do you know if the Great Wall has one?
Are you talking about like a walkway on the top?
Yes, a walkway on the top where people could walk like along the wall.
Well, I feel like this is cheating because I feel like I've seen images of people walking along the top. Like it's a pretty wide road.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm going to say yes.
Yes, it does.
And there's something like, I remember like hearing something a long time ago that like five horses could like walk side by side or something like that.
Freed. Wow. I did not know that.
That's well, amazing. And don't take my word for it either. Cause I could be misremembering that. It really does give you a sense of how amazing a feat it actually is. Right.
Yeah. It's, I think it probably is the most impressive thing that has ever been. I don't see anything that has been built. Like we've built a lot of impressive things, but like, I think it is the most of those. I mean, even if you put it back in the historical context too, I think it definitely is the greatest feat of construction by humanity.
I don't know about that. Have you seen Tom Cruise lately? He's 60 years old.
Yeah.
He looks like he's about 30. That's got to be man-made. There's something unnatural happening there.
For me, it's Thomas Sangster Brody. I don't understand. Who did he play Game of Thrones again?
Jojen.
Jojen Reed, yeah.
Yeah, Jojen.
And he is 30 and he looks 16. I don't understand what's going on.
Yeah, that there's some serious blood magic happening there.
Yeah, exactly.
So no, you're absolutely right. The Great Wall of China is the wonder of the world, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways, Martin's Wall is so magnificent that it's hard to imagine anything that would be more impressive than that in that world, right?
But the other thing is that the ice wall has been got breached, even though it had like this magical element to it, and that's also true of the Great Wall, right? Genghis Khan managed to breach, which I think Genghis Khan and the Night King, similar in a way. They just bring
interesting.
Doom.
Okay.
And yeah, so Genghis Khan breached the wall. He did it by luring out the Chinese. He told his to like act scared, and then everyone left the wall, be like, yeah, like chasing after them, and then he killed them all.
If there's gonna be a breach, it's gonna be a human element, right? It's always a problem with technology.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. That's like, it's like hacking.
Yeah. So he hacked it. He hacked exactly. The wall. All right, I'm going to do a quick synopsis of the chapter. Here's my synopsis. Tyrion is drinking, jesting, and mocking the elite members of the Night's Watch. He's with Jeremy and Riker and Bowen and Aemon and Lord Mormont. All seem to welcome his humor except one Alistair Thorne, who challenges Tyrion to a duel. Eventually, Alistair leaves in a huff, and Tyrion holds court again. The group dwindles until only Tyrion and Gior remain. Gior pleads with Tyrion to advocate more for more black brothers. He pleads with Tyrion to explain the dangers of winter, the lack of personnel, and the advancing others. Tyrion humors the old man and promises to bring his plea to King's Landing. Once outside, Tyrion decides to visit the top of the wall one last time. And there, he encounters Jon Snow, and the two say their goodbyes. So, Arthur, would you like to talk about a character, a plot point, a theme, or shall you and I just climb the ladder of chaos?
See, I don't know how season three's going, but in season two, the ladder of chaos was much too popular.
It's becoming, it's kind of becoming a cliche at this point.
Exactly. So I think I'm going to stay away from the ladder of chaos.
All right. Good. Well, you're with your accent, I would imagine. I mean, your accent is kind of, it really does give me the image of someone who's very London, Oxbrit, stayed. Have it under control. That's my impression. And chaos just doesn't go with that. I mean, chaos is for other less civilized people.
Yeah, I agree. I think I think I should build a wall to separate myself from the rest.
All right,
of the world.
So what do you want to talk about?
I think I want to talk about a theme. Because I think there's a really interesting like duality between like the two themes, which are like the horror element of this chapter and then the comedy element. And I think it ties in really well to the most interesting part of this, which I think is the friendship between Jon and Tyrion, which is maybe a bit unexpected. I guess I really want to peer into that.
Let's do it. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's kind of one of the key building blocks of this. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting because here we have these two key characters that are going to be integral to the story. And as far as the book goes, they're not going to see each other again.
Yeah, and it's, you like to think it's such a shame because I feel like they if they just teamed up all the time, surely they'd be unstoppable. Like, I feel like Jon has everything that Tyrion needs, and Tyrion has everything that Jon needs.
You're absolutely right that friendship could be really beneficial to both of those characters.
Yeah, I think Jon could be like the moral compass and the bravery and the strength of character that Tyrion has some of that, but maybe he's missing a bit. And then Tyrion could be the smarts, the cunning. He can also be just the humor and lighthearted. I think just Jon alone, without any of his friends, would just be sad all the time.
That's true, and I think you're right. And I think that Jon is one of the few people that actually, so far, that actually see Tyrion as someone to be admired. like Gior yeah. actually does too. You know, he says we need men of cunning at the wall, but even mm-hmm. that word cunning, doesn't it have like a some of a negative connotation? Like cunning, like yeah. you don't like if you want to call mm-hmm. someone brilliant, you could call them brilliant or smart or whatever. Cunning has just a little bit like, you're smart, but in a way I'm not sure I can trust.
Yeah, it's like Mr. Fox Fantastic. Is that his name?
Yeah. That's right. The Fantastic Mr. Fox. So
Fantastic Mr. Fox, yeah.
So, but John just sees Tyrion, I think really sees him as, this is someone who's impressive. This is someone to look up to. And I think very few people understand that about Tyrion at this point.
See, I came to a different conclusion because I thought that John keeps saying Lannister, and I think behind the words Lannister, it's a thinly veiled way of him saying, I don't really trust you because of your family. But Maester Aemon, I think, is the person who is the first person in the book to really see Tyrion as a giant that he is. He describes Tyrion as a giant, and Tyrion is surprised, and he's like, I've never been told that before. And I think Maester Aemon is seeing something, and I think that's kind of his gift. He's this wise man.
All right, that's a really interesting. I absolutely want to talk about Maester Aemon, but first I have to kind of follow up this other thing. So, when I hear John call people by their last name, I hear him making a class distinction and putting himself in sort of the beta role. Because he most often calls Rob Stark. Like when he's talking directly to his brother, he calls him Stark. And I think that that's his way of saying, I know my place in this family. And we're familiar. And so I'm going to call you just by that one name or whatever. But I'm going to remind everyone in the room that I know my place. So I think that there's like a class element there. And I think that he does the same thing with Tyrion.
Yeah, but in a way, I definitely agree. But I also think that maybe John is a bit more ambitious than we give him credit. Like when he tells Tyrion to go to Rob and to tell him about how he should, you know, stop fighting and stop being a lord because he's going to handle everything and become a lord commander. I was like, well, this is a very John, is it now? Sounds like Littlefinger or something.
He's not the best with jokes.
Yeah.
It's his attempt. His sword isn't nearly as sharp yet. I hear you on that. So you think that John, when he says Lannister, you think that there's like a little bit like, I'm not sure if I can trust Lannisters.
I think maybe I'm being influenced by the show here.
I'm not sure either.
When I watched the scene earlier, I felt like John was saying Lannister a bit dryly instead of saying Tyrion. But maybe I misread something.
That's interesting. Let's go with your interpretation. I want to let you know though that when I heard Tyrion say that, or I saw it on the page or whatever, I thought, here's the only guy that's actually giving Tyrion respect. He's not calling him the dwarf. He's not calling him, you know, some stupid name, the imp or whatever. Let's pause that for a minute. I absolutely want to talk about Aemon. All right, I'm going to read this little passage. Here's what Aemon says. He says, "Oh, I think that Lord Tyrion is quite a large man," Maester Aemon said from the far end of the table. He spoke softly, yet the high officers of the Night's Watch all fell quiet, the better to hear what the ancient had to say. "I think he is a giant come among us, here at the end of the world." Tyrion answered gently, "I've been called many things, my lord. But giant is seldom one of them." "Nonetheless," Maester Aemon said, as his clouded, milk-white eyes moved to Tyrion's face, "I think it is true." So you think that Aemon sees Tyrion more clearly than anyone else at the table, or it may be anyone else in the story.
Yeah, like exactly the same way that he sees Jon better than everything else. I think that's the big thing about Aemon, is that he might not literally see, but he sees much more than everyone else, which is a bit of a trope, right? Blind people can see what other people can't. But it's just so well written. Just I get chills to think about this Quiet Place Damon saying that.
Okay, I've got a question about this, but I absolutely want to get to your theme first. So tell me more about the theme that you were on about earlier.
Yeah, I just think that Tyrion comes into this world where there's a lot of horror. Like, for example, the way that Tyrion describes past the war and the haunted forest really is very Stephen King-y in the way that George R. R. Martin writes it, in the way that they predict doom. You have all those horror themes in it. But in the meanwhile, you have Tyrion putting in his jokes and his jeers and his jabs. It's very striking. It really brings out Tyrion's character and his environment. And like, I think the best way to illustrate it is the raven at the beginning of the chapter that keeps interrupting everyone, that like says, repeats duel when Sir Alison Thorne like threatens Tyrion with a duel, and then like repeats fool when Mormont is like deep in his chat about how, oh, like self-pity about being a fool. And it's like the idea that a raven is not meant to be for comedy, right? No one uses raven to create comedy. You would use a parrot or something. But George R. R. Martin, I think, is doing this intentionally, right? He's really trying to show this is a world of horror, and Tyrion is bringing in humor here. And he sees things humanly, and we're seeing it from his eyes.
Yeah, it's like gallows humor. And there's something about that can kind of bring the truth into a situation in kind of a benign way. Mm-hmm. At the same time, I do think that Tyrion, in his heart of hearts, does not believe that the Night's Watch is an old and noble profession. He thinks it's a farce. I mean, he thinks it's an old profession, but I think that he thinks the Night's Watch is ridiculous. And the people that think that they're doing any good up here, if this is anything more than a penal colony or whatever, they're fooling themselves. So when he makes a joke, Alistair Thorne actually is right in that Tyrion is making fun of them.
Yeah, and I think in a way, the fact that Tyrion comes from a different perspective to them, he comes with a perspective of misunderstanding of their position, and they come and they're like, we don't understand this man who just jokes around and thinks everything is funny. But in a way that kind of enables them to see things about each other that no one else sees. He's our first introduction to someone else in the world starting to question. He might not actually question it on paper in this chapter, but the reader is starting to think, I feel like Tyrion is less and less certain, and he starts to respect the wall more and more, and respect the people at the wall. And I think the people at the wall see something in Tyrion that other people might not, because they also have this different perspective than others.
Right. Right. And he's smart.
He's smart.
And so there are very few people that are going to assess a situation in the same way that Tyrion will. Mm. And I think Jorah sees that, you know, he's we could use men like you up here. Of course, Jorah's willing to take anyone.
That's his job.
That's his job, just to take anyone. but he kind of looks around the room and says, there's no one here that can really take over for me when I'm gone. You know, most of these guys can't read. You know, I know what these men are, and they're not leaders, which kind of introduces this sort of deficit. It's like a hole that we would assume that eventually someone's going to need to fill, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know that that's going to be Jon eventually. But anyway, I think that the point here is that Tyrion does bring something new, unique, fresh to this really old institution.
Do we think Jorah is like a sleazy salesman that has the same phrases for everybody? And he goes, you're special. We need someone like you.
I think he has to. I mean, anyone who's willing to visit.
Yeah.
You know, he's probably pleading with everyone that is willing to visit.
I think he has a script.
Yeah. 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 He probably does. I mean, not to say that he's not also impressed by Tyrion, but I think he sees in Tyrion a way to get into the ear of the king in a way that he wouldn't have otherwise.
Absolutely.
I've got a question for you about what Aemon says. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the second time the Tyrion has been described as a giant.
Yeah.
The first time he was with Jon Snow, and when he walks away, his shadow is cast behind him, and the shadow is like, it could be the shadow of a giant. It's so big, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
And then, all right, and then so Master Aemon says this, and he says it very directly, and it's not meant to be a joke. He's trying to say, and everyone at this at the table knows, he's trying to say something true about Tyrion, mm-hmm. right? So then later on in Dance, Tyrion meets this red priest named Mokoro. Mm-hmm. And Mokoro has a vision of Tyrion wherein he's a giant. That could be like a metaphor that he's, you know, he's actually a really important guy, even though he's short of stature or whatever. I don't know how, what to think about this. I have been waiting and I have been entertaining this idea that Tyrion will undergo some kind of physical transformation.
Ooh. Honestly, I'm surprised that Bran didn't have like a vision of Tyrion stepping on King's Landing or something.
Oh, that's it. Well, he does. Bran does see an image of a giant. But it's like a stone giant, and we're not really sure what that means. But
yeah.
So okay, so all right. So here's the other thing about these guys, all these guys. Mm-hmm. I think it's possible that it has something to do with dragons. I don't know what. Don't know what it what? Is.
Wait, where did the dragons come from?
Well, here's the thing. I think that Jon and Aemon are Targaryens, right? We know that.
Mm-hmm.
Mokoro has become this sort of prophet that's promoting Dany. And Tyrion's always had this fascination for dragons. And I think that he's not like on some kind of collision course with Dany. And I think he's about to become sort of the military mind behind the dragons.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I don't know if Tyrion's a secret Targaryen. I don't know if he's gonna ride a dragon. I don't know any of this. I don't know.
I feel like he needs to ride the dragon. I think that's accepted.
So I guess there are three times, and Martin likes to do this, three times where this thing is said about Tyrion. It can't go nowhere. It has to come to fruition in some way. So it could just be a metaphor. It could just be he's going to become like a giant military presence. But I wonder, and it's a world of magic. I wonder if there's something else happening there.
Well, I think that's fair, because if you look at Daenerys, right? It's mentioned in the first book once that she takes a hot bath and then she's immune to fire. So mm-hmm. I think it's a fair conclusion to say that, okay, maybe giant is mentioned three times, but that still could be he turns into a giant, or, you know, bride to dragon.
Martin does. I mean, he has said that he will often do this with a plot reveal. Like, he'll drop a little breadcrumb so that the really astute readers will, like, perk up their eyes. And then the second time he drops it, it's pretty obvious that that's where he's going. But then he'll do a third one that kind of hits you over the head with it in case you didn't catch the first two. Or whatever. But he does like to employ that kind of storytelling. Anyway, I thought it was really interesting that Aemon says it and it's not explained. It's like everyone knows he's not joking, but and in addition to that, Tyrion says, "Oh well, you're too kind," and then he says, "I'm rarely described as kind." So it's not like he's just giving him a compliment. There's something about what Aemon says here that's, I think, it's supposed to foreshadow some kind of transformation, whether it's metaphorical or whatever.
You're right. I think Tyrion clearly has an attraction to Targaryens. I think Targaryens clearly see mm-hmm. Tyrion in a way that mm-hmm. others don't. In this chapter, we have a lot of foreshadowing. I mean, it literally is.
So tell me about the other foreshadowing in this chapter.
Well, evidently there is a lot of foreshadowing about the others coming down and all the evidence of why they think mm-hmm. that exists. There's quite a bit of foreshadowing when Tyrion says goodbye to everybody, that all these people are going to die. George R. R. Martin says, and he left him in that manner. And, you know, you're kind of thinking...
Yeah, it's very ominous the way he says it, right?
It's very creepy. Yeah, and obviously there's a lot of foreshadowing. This is the first time that realistically, because, okay, Tyrion coming into contact with the idea of the others, that's not the first time the reader comes into contact sure. with that. But the idea that Tyrion is a huge character, that's new to the right. reader. I mean, this is the third chapter of Tyrion in a while, and this is the first time that people consistently are saying, this guy's really special. And so, in a way, maybe this is Martin's way to really hammer that.
Yeah,
in.
That's right. And it really, this first book is very much about people doubting the supernatural, right? At least the people mm-hmm. that need to know, it would be helpful if they knew that the others are real and mm-hmm. the dragons are real and things like that. People are continually disbelieve this, and Tyrion's like a great example of this. He really does doubt all the snark and grump.
Yeah,
talk.
And see, I have a bone to pick with this, because you often talk about how this is a world on the edge of modernity.
Yeah, I've said that a couple times,
right?
Sure.
My issue with that is, how can it be on the edge of modernity when everything that's modern about them comes from an institution of the Maces that goes back thousands of years?
Oh, that's interesting.
That's kind of what I don't understand, is how, like, when scientific institutions yeah. like that come up, like, it's not true that academics are useless and they don't lead to progress in society. You know what I mean? Like, if you're going to have that much science, it's going to feed into you kind of stepping away from... from like a position of the Middle Ages and that.
Well,
that kind
okay.
of...
Let me defend the position just a little bit here. So, so you know, you got some pretty heavy yeah. hitters. In Athens, you've got some, you know, people like Augustine are, you know, highly academic people. You've got people all throughout the quote unquote Middle Ages who are really, really smart people. But what ends up happening is, it's not like the people are necessarily getting smarter than the geniuses of the past. But what happens at the edge of modernity is that there's a lot of different schools of thought that end up starting to point in one direction. And you see that with the Renaissance, yeah. and you see that then again with sort of the natural sciences a little bit later. And what I'm saying with Martin's world is that there's this key shift away from the supernatural in this one moment of time. So it's like the Maesters are finally at a yeah. point where, like, dragons are in the past. And, you know, let's think academically about these things. Let's use, like, good, solid yeah. reasoning to try to sort of dispel some of these old myths. This really is kind of a hybrid. Like, Martin's creating a hybrid where some people in the world are very much sort of grasping forward to progress. But for the most part, people are not done with magic yet. So I do think that there's something yeah. of a hybrid setting happening.
Yeah, I think I agree. I think it definitely serves the purpose of his storytelling. So if that's true, I think in the world on the cusp of modernity, it's missing for me two things, which is, in those worlds, there's quite a fast technological advancement, and you don't see that in this world. And there's also a lot of curiosity and a lot of open-mindedness. Closed-mindedness is something that you see, closed-mindedness of from bringing scientific thoughts and pushing things away that you're quite certain don't exist, come because you are modern, and so you know if dragons exist or not. But if you live in a world where no one has really gone, that you don't know what's north of the wall, and literally no one has gone there, it's curious to me that people write it off, because, I mean, magic and the others are, dragons and the others are magic to us because they don't exist in our world, but it's not magic to them. Like, it's scientific to them. Well, it should be scientific to them. I felt like Martin is kind of bringing his biases.
This is the work for the story. Here's why it actually is important that someone like Tyrion or someone like the Maesters exist in this world, is that here we have, you know, some of the really smart and bright people of the world. And basically they can function as a stand-in for the modern mind. So I'll read this little passage here. As he stood there and looked at the darkness, with no fires burning anywhere, the wind blowing and the cold like a spear in his guts, Tyrion felt as though he could almost believe the talk of the others, the enemy in the night. His jokes of Grumpkins and Snarks no longer seemed quite so droll. The only reason that a paragraph like that works is if Martin has done the hard work really, really hitting us over the head with Tyrion skepticism. So if we kind of see ourselves through Tyrion's eyes, or see this world through Tyrion's eyes, then we kind of inhabit that role of the skeptic, which of course we should. We live in a world where Tyrion's right. You know, if Tyrion lived in our world, he would absolutely be right. You know, there's no Snarks and Grumpkins. But in Tyrion's world, if a guy like Tyrion, who's a famous skeptic at this point, can kind of start to wonder, well, I wonder if this talk of the others is actually true. Then, of course, then it kind of serves that purpose for us. We start to think, oh, crap. Like, and we know that they are true. And so we can kind of experience Tyrion's sense of awe, his sense of horror in that way. So I guess my point is that there's a few characters in the story that function in that way as sort of skeptics of magic. I think Maester Luwin is one of those characters. I think that I think Tyrion is one of those characters. And so then the reveal of magic is all the more
and I think that's
exciting.
Why George's writing in A Game of Thrones is such good fantasy writing. It's that even if you are someone like your friend Steve, who isn't really into dragons and fantasy and everything, he uses these characters to kind of slowly introduce you and slowly make you believe. And he does exactly the same things with the dragons, right? No one believes that the dragon eyes are going to become dragons. He slowly makes you believe that this might happen, and then they're tiny dragons and they become big. And so this like slow burn, instead of like, okay, you're in this fantasy world and I'm immediately introducing all of the things that you're not comfortable with, he starts with a world that you're comfortable with and he slowly introduces them and uses the skepticism of the characters to kind of counterpoint. I think you're right, your own.
Right. Well, he uses the skepticism to help you forget what you learned in the prologue, right?
Mm-hmm.
So some notable introductions. We have a few members of the Night's Watch that are mentioned, or at least we see them for the first time. We hear about the lights of Moletown. Tyrion gets a good view of the crumbling walls of Castle Black. And really, you know, the top of the wall. The top of the wall is like... I mean, it really gives you kind of sense of the darkness all around Tyrion. And so this chapter, I wouldn't say it introduces the concept of the White Walkers or the impending darkness or, you know, the long winter or whatever, but it really kind of tries to drive home the, you know, this looming horror.
Yeah. And I think there's also a good parallel with people's experience when they go sit on Hadrian's Wall and they can see like the fog and they feel kind of scared of what's past the horizon. I think that's also what Martin's trying to say here.
Yeah, anything's possible beyond the edge of the world. Book versus show differences. Maybe you could help me with this. You recently rewatched these scenes, right?
Yeah. Mormont laughs, and he laughs so much that he like spits out his food.
Right.
What is going on? That is not the Mormont that I know.
No. Yeah, Mormont is he's an old bear, right?
Yeah, exactly, right? He's stoic.
So yeah, it's a different portrayal of that character for sure.
We have more Khorne again. I don't know what's up with ravens and Khorne, but
yeah, more Khorne. Do you think that there's something happening gives the raven with the raven? Do you think the raven, there's more to the raven than meets the eye?
Are you trying to say it's Bran? That's
I was thinking I don't know, maybe it could be like the Three-Eyed Crow. You know, we know that the Three-Eyed Crow can inhabit.
I agree, but then he'd just be having fun because he's not bringing anything to the table.
Not really. I mean, half the time he's saying corn, so I don't want to read too much into this. Right? Anyway.
Yeah.
It says, are there any other that strike you as important?
Yeah, the striking scene of Tyrion peeing off the wall. And I think I think in a way it really shows the difference of how Tyrion is introduced in the show compared to the book. In the book, in the first scene, he's kind of introduced as silly.
Yeah.
But then that kind of when he goes to the wall, he is silly, but he's not disrespectful to the wall in that way. And I felt like him peeing off the wall on the show was kind of a show of disrespect that kind of, for me, shows the difference where they're kind of hurrying Tyrion into the personality that we'll know later,
right,
in the book.
Yeah.
I feel like late Tyrion would definitely pee off the wall, but early Tyrion would not do that. I'm not sure he gained the confidence to do that yet. But the show it goes faster, and I'm not sure young Tyrion is the Tyrion that people like. And so the show went, you know what, we'll go straight with later Tyrion.
So I didn't remember this till just now, but it's almost like Tyrion's got like a bucket list where he like he wants to pee off the edge of the world or whatever in the show.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So when I was in junior high, and I'm not proud of this, Arthur. I'm not proud of this at all. But my parents were driving our family across the, you know, Western United States, you know, basically on our way to the Grand Canyon.
Okay.
You know, which is this magnificent, beautiful sight.
I see where this is
going.
You
know, no one has ever, you know, no one could ever not be in awe of the Grand Canyon. You know,
absolutely.
It's always more impressive than anyone could ever explain. You know, that's all the mythology around it.
That's what they say, yeah.
Not to a junior high boy, Arthur. When we got to the Grand Canyon, I was like asleep in the back of the van, and my parents were like, "We're at the Grand Canyon." I was like, "I don't care. I'm going to sleep back here." So I was very much sort of like drunken Tyrion or whatever. Like I get coaxed, like, look, we came all the way to the Grand Canyon. You got to come out. And I was not thrilled with the idea. And I was just determined to be like just an asshole, as you know, as a lot of junior high boys are.
Absolutely.
And I did indeed pee off the edge of the Grand Canyon.
Wow. That means I think that's quite cool, actually.
I mean now I'm a father of junior hires, and I can't, my children are so great, they would never do anything like that, but I was just an asshole back then. Or at least if you wake me up and I'm tired and I don't want to get out of the van, I absolutely be an asshole. So this is good, we come full circle. In our first interview we talked about fog
yeah,
coming out of a warrior's penis, and now this. I've not told many people this story, so I'm a little bit reluctant to actually put this in the podcast. But I would hope that someone, you know, you can kind of, I'm a different person than I was when I was in junior.
No, yeah, don't try this at home or wherever.
I mean, honestly, I think it would have been justified for anyone to, if they saw me doing that, to just walk up behind me and push me in. That would be totally justified, because that was totally disrespectful.
I think it's a good two truths to one lie.
That's not bad. That's not bad.
Yeah, because no one's going to think you actually did that. I think there's a thing about how teenagers' brains are wired. I remember I went to Safari in South Africa, yeah, and I was listening to podcasts the whole time. And it's like the way to not be in the moment.
that's kind of a junior high move right there.
Yeah. Right?
Uh-huh. Arthur, such a pleasure. I really appreciate your afternoon. And, you know, you've done a lot of hard work. I think you deserve a nice cold beverage.
Thank you very much. Honestly, thank you so much for talking to me.
Yeah,
I love this podcast. I think it's really enriching, and I'm just honored to be here, honestly.
Here are the weekly highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
Apple TV is releasing a new series based on Blake Crouch's novel Dark Matter. Aaron and I are big fans of his work, so we're picking up the new show on day one. Join us this Wednesday for the preview podcast.
The Shogun Limited series might be over, but that doesn't mean our Shogun coverage has to end. We've got the wrap-up podcast releasing this Tuesday, where we'll consider all your feedback and final thoughts on a series. And because we like the show so much, we decided to go all the way back to 1980 to cover the first TV adaptation of the novel. Do what you can to find a copy and join us this Thursday for the first of our four-part podcast on 1980 Shogun miniseries.
And finally, the latest first-run movie, The Fall Guy, features Emily Blunt and Ryan Gosling. He's a stuntman tasked with finding the star of his ex-girlfriend's movie when he suddenly goes missing. Is it a rom-com? Yes. Does that mean I'll automatically hate it? Not if the trailer lives up to its promise. Join us for the podcast on Bald Move Pulp this Thursday night.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app.
And now Steve and I cover Dark Wings, Dark Words. This is the episode that has that great fight on the bridge between Jaime and Brienne, and John meets a warg up north of the wall. And Lady Olenna, one of my favorites, pries the truth out of Sansa about Joffrey. It's one of my favorite episodes. Here is Steve Osborne. Steve, I'm going to start with a bold statement.
Okay.
I think this was the perfect Game of Thrones episode.
Whoa, that is a bold statement.
There are Game of Thrones episodes that are sort of jaw-dropping, that raise the cultural currency of the show more.
Sure.
But I just, you know, just want solid Game of Thrones bread and butter. I think this was the episode.
Okay, go on.
I think that's it. That's all.
Okay, well, I mean, that's all I gotta say. That's all you have to do. The burden of proof is clearly on me.
I loved the subtle amount of magic. You know, there's certainly magic stuff, but done, I think, tastefully enough so that you didn't feel like you're in the fantasy genre. It feels like you're in, like Heather says, a more an adventure show.
Sure.
Couple interesting little twists that I enjoyed. Mostly the dialogue was great. That's how I feel.
Got it. Okay.
And you?
I feel like this is one that, to me, felt like it was moving things along, but it left me wanting.
Really? Wow. I think this is a new territory for us.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, so let's talk about what left you wanting, or what you might have done differently had you been at the reins.
The issue that we have with the narrative quite like this, where it's so complex, is, you know, we try to look at these episodes in a vacuum. That's what we're doing for this particular review, right? But we're really looking at these episodes in terms of how it's moving the narrative along. And this one really felt like one that was moving the narrative along. And I mean, don't get me wrong, it was compelling, well-acted, great dialogue, all that stuff. But in terms of like, wow, this is not one of those episodes. I felt like this was a necessary episode. I felt like we're getting on to the next thing. I mean, I was fascinated that the fact that, you know, Bran wakes up and he's 27 years old. I mean, that's a nice twist.
Did we see Bran at all in season 3?
This is the first time we've seen him, right? So he's aged a lot.
Yeah. He certainly has. You got that little note late in the episode that Jamie's been captive for a full year.
Right, right.
So I think that you're...
Now we're getting some timeline, right?
Yeah, you're supposed to get the idea that quite a bit of time has actually passed. And of course, you know, one of your main actors hits puberty. There's not a whole lot you can do.
No, not really. They can't do the Malcolm in the Middle thing, right? Where the inimitable Frankie Muniz, Agent Cody Banks and whatnot... He hits puberty, and I think they actually have him like doing like modifying his voice, so it almost sounds like a speech impediment in some of these later episodes, because he's creating some sort of an impression of himself.
Well, this is famously the Urkel problem.
The Urkel problem. Yes. I mean, the Urkel problem echoes, right?
I mean, the Urkel problem.
We're still wrestling with the Urkel problem.
The Urkel problem, you know, after a while, he got very tall, very thin. He still had the glasses, but boy, he was just trying to be Urkel. He was trying his hardest to be Urkel.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like he went from being like prepubescent to like going through a midlife crisis, and he still.
Yeah. He became Dwayne from Different World before our eyes. So, yeah. Did that take you out of the show that he had aged up that much?
No, but there was that moment where you're just like, oh, okay. Because, you know, I mean, just all right. He's a man. That's fine. I didn't dislike this episode by any stretch, but this is just one that was just like, for me, was maybe part of it is like, hey, here's some new characters. And I'm like, good Lord, I'm trying to keep up.
Oh yeah. Okay. So let's talk about the new characters. There were quite a few new characters actually.
And I think maybe that's what it was hard for me to fully appreciate. Cause I'm like, I'm invested in all these guys, and now you're giving me a little less of these guys because we got to bring in these new ones.
So one of my favorite characters in this show, in all of this show, is Lady Olenna.
Okay.
And she's the grandmother of Marjorie.
Yeah, she's got a little spunk.
I just love that character. So we'll talk about her a little bit later. We met Thoros, who's sort of the drunken leader of the Brothers Without Banners.
Yeah.
We met Jojen and Mira. We meet Theon's captors, but they're unnamed, right?
Yeah, but this is Ramsay's crew, right? Or is that what we don't know? Or
I think that a judicious observer will probably make that assumption, right?
Gotcha.
I think that they didn't want to reveal that right away, but there's so many hints that there's one house that does a lot of torturing, right?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like their thing.
It's their thing. It's
what they do. They've even made a logo about it.
If you want a truck, you got to get a Ford. if you want a man flayed, you go to the Boltons.
That's just the way it is. I mean, it's...
Speaking of flayed men, we also meet Locke at the very end of the episode. And I don't think he's named. He's the guy that takes Jaime and Brienne captive at the end.
Gotcha. Okay.
So you're right. There are tons of new characters introduced.
We got a was it a warg or a warg? What do they call the
warg?
Yeah, it's like a warg. Okay.
Yeah, we meet a warg.
Sure. Why wouldn't we?
Yeah. Well, in addition to that, they use that weird looking warg guy to also reinforce sort of the rules around magic relative to Bran, right?
Right. Okay. Yeah.
So I guess you could say we meet two wargs in this episode. We just didn't know what to call Bran beforehand.
Sure.
Seemingly, Bran's dreams make him something a little bit more than a warg. I think that the correct term is going to be green seer, but what Asha calls it is black magic dreams.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that might be show only. I don't think that they use that phrase in the books, but you use the phrase black magic dreams. It's shorthand. You know, most viewers are going to get a sense of what that would look like.
Right. They're longing for a Fleetwood Mac song or something.
Yeah. Or I want a black magic
raven.
I want a black magic raven. It was right there in front of me. And this is why we bring on a professional comic.
That's right.
All right. So I got some good dialogue from a few of my favorite characters. And I got to be introduced to a couple characters that I really like. And there were just a couple scenes that I just thought were wonderful. So let me give
characters I really like. Now, these are characters you like because of the book?
No, I think.
Did you already have like, oh, good, it's these guys?
Good question.
Because that might be where I'm having a disconnect, right? Because
okay. Here's the full backstory on Lady Olenna in my viewing. I don't think she's that memorable to me from the books.
Okay.
Although I do remember her having a few good one-liners or whatever. But I remember feeling a special affection for her in the show.
Okay.
And the reason why is that, gender aside, she reminds me of my doctoral supervisor, James Dunn. their affect, the kind of jokes that they make, their sort of sardonic humor. But yeah, she reminds me of someone that I like a lot already. And maybe that's why I like her. But I think she's a smart character. I like smart characters. I think that she's genuinely funny at times. I like that too. If I was going to want to listen to a Game of Thrones podcast that was hosted by two in-world characters, I would want Tyrion and Lady Olenna. That would be okay. My choice.
There we go. All right. So that makes sense. I mean, and the thing is, she was great. I mean, the introduction of that character felt it felt necessary on a couple levels. It's a drop of water in Sansa's, like, barren wasteland right now, right? I mean, like,
yeah. And in addition to that, we already knew that Margaery was a formidable character.
Right.
So in addition to that, in addition to her being a formidable character, now she kind of has her own Tyrion.
Yeah.
Right? She's got this person who's smart, who's sort of behind the scenes, giving her advice, who's playing the game. And in a lot of ways, she is sort of Tyrion for the Tyrells. And I like the idea that Tyrion's going to have another intelligent match.
A game player.
Yeah, right. Someone to go up against. But
which is his thing. That's what he likes.
That's what he likes. So one of the scenes that I really liked in this show was that, they're sort of really grilling Sansa to talk about Joffrey. Like, what's he really like? And basically they're fishing. They're doing some reconnaissance. And Sansa lets her guard down and finally says he's a monster. I loved Margaery's sort of like, oh, that's kind of a bummer eye roll.
Right.
To me, that says so much about her character. That's not like,
oh, yeah.
Oh, I no, mean, I'm then, marrying a then, monster. It's sort of like, oh, now we got to deal with that.
Well, and then she goes and is like, all right, I'm going to play to his monsterness.
That's right. And so she, to me, that just that little like, oh, that's a bummer eye roll that she gives at that table makes me think this person just got the information she needed to manipulate someone like Joffrey, who is, I'm on the record as saying he's too stupid to live. And and it's really going to be no match. She's just going to steamroll him, it seems to me.
Right. And then which also lends to a little bit more to the is Cersei has been threatened by her, and the question I have still is it because does she understand? Does she have some inkling on how crafty?
I think Margaery so. I think is. When Cersei says, "Look, she does this charity work for a reason." She knows that there's something deeper there, right?
And she's downplaying her concern to Joffrey, right? Like she's trying to. She keeps it like her concern fairly superficial to Joffrey because one, I think I also believe she believes that he's too stupid to live.
Right.
And so she's managing him to the best of her ability.
She's trying to teach him politics and he's totally immune to it.
Right. And so she can't tell him, okay, this is what she's going to do and whatever. Cause he's just not, he doesn't have the capacity. So yeah, that was, I thought was a fascinating twist how she manage that scene, because at one point you're like, oh, is he going to be cruel to her? But then she just plays it, and then just and he continues to be a very malleable for Margaery, which is great. And so then now you have Sansa, and this helps too, I think, add a little bit more depth, because we've asked a lot of questions about Sansa, like, does she believe this? Is she really like just all in on this Joffrey's my king notion? And so that was helped to sort of break that part of the character. So
yeah, she finally it's finally a release for that character. So the other scene that I liked a lot in this episode, I really love this exchange between Jaime and Brienne. When Jaime gets that sword from her, there's just this look of blissful satisfaction on his face.
When Superman, reverses.
Yes.
That energy or whatever.
Yeah, this is a very Superman 2 thing where he's given up his powers.
Right. And then
he finally gets him back.
Yeah, when Zod goes in there and he's like, kneel, and then he crushes his hand, and Zod now is more human than
that was his Zod moment. Johnny. That's right. So I love that. I love that he goads her into expressing her affection for Renly. And then she lies a little bit. She says, oh, I was as close to him as anyone. And clearly she's not self-aware in that way. And he's sort of using that. And then finally he says, I don't blame you for it. We don't really choose the people that we love.
Right. That was a great line.
That was wonderful.
That was a really good line. In fact, I think that was maybe my favorite line in the show, because it really, again, it says so much without
saying a lot.
You know? Right. You're not meant to empathize with Jamie, but there's that moment where you start to realize, like when you start to think about, like, you know, looking at Rob and like the criticism he's getting because he's, you know, he married to Lisa and what everything is going on with that. And there's this sense of like, well, this is not right. Like his is more of a sense of duty. Whereas from Jamie's perspective or Jamie's narrative, it's like, well, this is just not right. Right. It's not, it's an unsavory relationship you have with Cersei. And Cersei clearly, while she is, you know, she loves Jamie, she's not above anybody in the family. Whereas Jamie seems to be.
Yeah. As long Jamie as she keeps it in the family.
Right.
She's Jamie not very discerning.
Jamie's 100% focused on her. It's the only woman he's been with. And when he says that, though, it really, it's the most vulnerable I think we've seen him, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that as viewers, we're sort of lulled into that vulnerability, right? We kind of view him as being somewhat powerless. And then when he gets that sword, it's like, oh, wow, now we're going to see something entirely different.
He seems to be enamored with Brienne. I think he tends to favor somebody who is good at fighting, right? Like not just fighting, but like the art of fighting.
I think he really genuinely likes her and respects her as a fighter. And at the same time, I really do think he was willing to kill her.
Exactly. And that's kind of where I was going to go, is that I think that there's this sense of like it would be an honor to fight you. It'd be an honor to kill you. And if you killed me, I mean, I don't want to die, but it would validate whatever respect he's starting to give. So there almost seemed like the fight in some way was, one, it's self-serving for sure. But there's an element of like, this is what you and I should do. This is what you and I are made to do.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that Jamie, now just so hit it off at the pass, I don't condone violence, nor do I condone incest. So Jamie is certainly a problem.
Do you not condone them the same, or is there one that you feel like, you know, there's a time and place for? And you don't have to tell me which one is which.
They're both in my top 10 of things I don't condone.
Okay. Right? One could be one and one could be 10.
But Jamie, I think Jamie views himself as an artist. I think he views himself, even when he's talked in the past about Sir Barristan, that he was a painter that only used red or whatever. I think he had that line. I really do think that he sees swordplay as this fine art, and he views himself as the best artist in the kingdom. And he is willing to die for it. He's willing to kill for it, but he's all about it. Like his identity is totally wrapped up into this one thing. So I think that there's something about meeting someone like Brienne who may have this in common with him that he's kind of thrilled by. So I like that scene. I like that scene a lot.
Yeah.
We have a reference to a Howland Reed in this episode. Howland Reed is the father of these new characters, Jojen and Mira.
Oh, okay.
And I suppose he and Ned were friends during Robert's Rebellion, and seemingly Howland Reed and Ned Stark share a secret, Steve.
Oh, okay.
That's going to come into play in later seasons anyway.
I like secrets. Yeah.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I've been rereading Caroline Larrington's book, Winter is Coming. And I thought a few paragraphs in here will answer a question that I got from Rebecca. So Rebecca asks, I don't know much about the War of the Roses, aside from a very superficial Wikipedia skim, but I've heard that George may have gotten some inspiration from this. If you all have any expertise in this historical event and the extent to which it may have inspired Game of Thrones, I'd be interested in knowing more. So, Rebecca, here are a few lines from Caroline Larrington's book, Winter is Coming. This is Bloomsbury Academic Press. By the way, I published a few books with Bloomsbury in the past, and I find them a joy to work with. So any authors out there, those are my two cents. This is Larrington on page 2. How far is the recent history of the Seven Kingdoms a reworking of the 15th century War of the Roses? Martin has declared the struggle for domination between the descendants of Edward III was an inspiration for the politics of Westeros. And the chime of Stark and York and Lannister and Lancaster is a suggestive one. Yet filtered through Martin's powerful imagination and the epic vision of the show creators Benioff and Weiss, the facts of history are transmuted into something richer, stranger, more archetypal. Take the princes of the tower. Listen up, Rebecca, here we are. Edward and Richard, the two sons of the Yorkist king Edward IV. After their father died suddenly in early 1483, their paternal uncle Richard, Duke of Gloucester, took charge of the boys, aged 12 and 9. They were lodged in the Tower of London in preparation for Edward's coronation. Then, mysteriously, they disappeared, and Uncle Richard seized the throne. Bran and Rickon were never in line for the Iron Throne. Side note here, Caroline, you might want to add a footnote here in the revision. Of course, though Bran becomes heir to Winterfell, but the motif of supposed death of the two innocent childs is refracted more than once in the series. In Elia Martell's children, as well as Catelyn's youngest sons. And similarly, Cersei has been compared to several other troublesome and feisty medieval queens. We have Margaret, we have Eleanor, we have Isabella, just to name a few. So in all of those ways, yes, Martin is drawing from War of the Roses, and he has said so much in print. I will say one little thing. I think I would strengthen a claim that Larrington makes here. Richard is accused of disappearing, murdering, you know, two young royal boys. That's exactly what happens to Tyrion. They're not brothers, but Tyrion is accused of attempting to murder Bran, and he is also accused of killing Joffrey. So yes, even though Martin is sort of flipping the history on its head and ratcheting up the stakes in a fantasy epic, you can really see the DNA for Tyrion in Richard's persona. And moreover, Richard is rumored, at least in the Tudor histories, to be a twisted and deformed person. And this is, you know, sort of bespeaking his twisted and deformed personality. So even if the rumors are not true, what Martin likes to do is he takes the rumors of the Middle Ages and then he imbues his characters with these and actualizes them. So Tyrion is often described as someone who has a twisted spine or something. I think that that is a direct homage to Richard. So, Rebecca, I hope that's helpful. And my thanks again to Caroline Larrington. Such a lovely book. I will look forward to having Caroline on in just a couple weeks.